Welcome to the Art Talk podcast, where I tell the stories of art, artists, and interview people in the arts. I am Karin Merks, your host, and I am an artist, art historian, teacher, and mentor. This is episode 85 of Art Talk, and today I have a special guest who lives in Mexico, is a photographer, and made a book called Looking at Mexico, Mexico Looks Back. Janet Sternberg has written 8 successful books, taught at Call Arts, and exhibited her photography in gallery shows in Los Angeles, New York, Berlin, Mexico, Seoul, Milan, and Bombay. Welcome, Janet. I'm so happy to have you as my guest. I'm honored to have you as my guest.
I am honored. And as I said in the conversation leading up to your introduction, yours are the best set of questions. The material that I got preparatory to this interview that I've ever received. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Really, really touches me. Thank you. So you made a book, Looking at Mexico and Mexico Looks Back. But it has a more profound meaning than just a simple title. That's what I feel. But could you tell us about that and why you chose the specific photo on the cover that is so multi-layered that you need to look at it for a long time before you actually start to see?
Those questions are beautifully related. First one, why the title? You say chose, quote unquote. Unlike most of my other books both of writing, because I'm also a writer of literary books and photography both, I've had to work and work at the right title. This title came to me like that. And I did not question it, unusual. And it goes to one of the most single important things about the book, and it's expressed really in the first sentence of my introduction. How can I, a gringa, meaning someone from the United States, foreign, living in Mexico, put forward a book so that it doesn't seem as though it's just me looking at Mexico? This is a kind of, it's something many, many, many books do. They assume that their view, without ever saying it, is the view.
Mm-hmm.
That it certainly is theirs, and perhaps even the one that is the one. Mine is not the one. It is not my Mexico. I needed to have, as I say in the introduction, a sense of reciprocity between me and the photographs. And until I had that, I was not going to do the book. I've started taking photographs in Mexico a while ago. As a surprise, we can talk about that later if you'd like, and develop my own way, now ways plural, of how I envision, embody an image, the sense of Mexico. But I just refuse to be the person that says, whatever that is, it belongs to me in some way. Mm-hmm. It was important to establish that this is also a book in which Mexico can look back. And that happens on several levels. Level one is how I got lucky. I discovered by good chance what I think of as a magnificent collaborator.
Mm-hmm.
I'll come back to that in a minute. But the book is simply, literally, not just mine.
Yeah.
Number two is that the photos that I chose I chose them really very, very rigorously. which is my style anyway, and everything I do. I don't want to mess around with anything, but the way it is, that's right, at least by my standards. And that goes to your question of the cover. Hmm. Initially, the publisher, and I've now published 3 photo books with Distanz Verlag in Berlin. Initially, they and I came up with one idea for the cover, and it's not that cover. It's a cover, it's a quite a good photograph. You know the book, so I can tell you that it's the one, I think it's the second one. It's you see the face of a young boy, and he's looking up, and there's a kind of plaid. Well, I won't try to describe it, but the point is, it's lovely, it's oblique, but it is at some level literal.
Yeah.
And I did not want anything literal. Mm-hmm. I did not want anything that had even the slightest sense of folkloric. I did not want straight-ahead documentary, all of which I admire, but it's not what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And so I had taken the photograph now on the cover as I walked down a street not long ago and discovered something that always attracts me, and that is abandoned cars. And I circle around the car, and ultimately this image, which is definitely not an obvious image. What it is a windshield and the hood of a car. And because the car is abandoned and been there for a while, there are the fronds, the leaves from the tree above, falling on the hood. But it's more abstract than that, to use abstract in a very broad sense, in that it's not instantly readable. You are seeing the light coming through the window. You are seeing something that is transformational in the way that we can talk about, I'm quite sure, later, because you picked up on that in the book. And it doesn't fall into any of those obvious cliches. I love the photograph. I said, what about this one? They said, yes.
Yeah.
We're off and running with, of course, the front cover having the title in English, done by a really good designer, I might add, based in Cologne. And the title in Spanish, mm-hmm. Mexican Spanish, in the back, still on top of the photograph as it continues. And I say that lastly to emphasize that the book is completely bilingual. English and Mexican Spanish.
And Mexican Spanish,
I worked with a poet in the United States who knows quite a lot about all things Mexican. And I did not want Castilian Spanish. I wanted the book to say what the title says.
Yeah. Yeah. And it does.
Good.
I've never been in Mexico. I want to go to Mexico. But it is as if it looks back at you. It does. It gives you insights in things you don't know. That I don't know, I have to say it like that. And the first time I received a copy and looked at the photo, I had to really like, what is this? First I thought it is kind of a wall with a mirror, and then there is some bright, and then I saw, oh no, wait, because you can look through. And oh wait, no, I can see that this is a seat or something. And it is so beautiful how this old car has transitioned into something, and you created art out of it, which makes it so endlessly beautiful.
Well, thank you. There is I think probably the second or first photograph, second, that I took in Mexico. This was 1998. So I started not as a kid.
No.
That photograph is also of an abandoned car, and it also lives in and with light, although it's more obviously a car. But I called that photograph way back then splendor.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, the splendor was the way that light and the photograph that I took transfigured a wreck into something of splendor.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yes, that
yeah.
is what I want. Also, your comment of what is it, and then your subsequent looking is exactly the way I want people to look at my work. Because for me, the question that makes me least happy is, what is it? Because if you have to answer directly, I feel it's a little bit, you know, when people have in the past at least caught butterflies and they've pinned them to the wall.
Yeah.
I don't want to pin anything to any wall that says, this is what it is. This is what it's about. But I don't want to be obscure either. I would just like people to do what you did, which is to look and look again and look again in a state of interest, curiosity, and wonder, not trying to pin it down.
Exactly.
And lastly, you gave me something in the way that you saw it, because you said something. I'm going to have to re-find it in my mind right now. It was about how, how the light in it, in effect, looks back at you, which is not something I quite knew and didn't know really now. Because there's something we don't know, as I'm sure you know.
Exactly. But that's what you say at the end. And that, I think that's the one of the most beautiful quotes. One of your gifts is to give that which you don't know.
Yeah.
That is so profound.
How you see it as profound.
Because we live in a world where we think that we know everything. And we create pretty mediocre solutions for a lot of things. But there is so much wisdom that you don't actually see, but that you feel. Like how looking at Mexico, Mexico looks back, intuitively comes into you, you know it's okay. That's not knowledge. That's not knowing. That is a very intuitive knowing, which is different knowing than from learning from a book and having lists and pinning down and writing the cards next to a museum thing. What you give and what I experienced is, and maybe that's because I do that myself when I paint portraits, I have to really start seeing and focus, and it expands my perception of what I see and how I see it, and I start to feel into it. And that is what I felt with this photo and with many photos of from your book, to be honest.
Well, I'm so glad. Again, you know, there's a kind of easy assumption that not knowing is a kind of ignorance. On the contrary, it's a kind of suspension, you know, that wonderful phrase of Keats, which I'm about to misquote, but no irritable searching for, well, that is more to the phrase than that, but I've always liked that irritable searching, which I may even misquote, but I don't think so. It also speaks to something that in the previous book of mine, Book of Photography with Text, I've Been Walking, which is the year of COVID, when I felt that I had to go out into the city, at that point Los Angeles, and ultimately find traces of the human, although the human was by and large gone. At the end of that, I quote, my introduction, I quote the Spanish poet Machado, who said, there is no path. You make the path as you walk.
Yep. It's true.
And the other thing about not knowing is it leaves room for mystery.
Yeah.
And it leaves room for asking questions. For example, in the book that precedes I've Been Walking, which was the first photo book I've done, also from Distance, called Overspilling World, I also wrote a piece in that book. And in it, one of the things I talk about is the mystery, and I'm quoting myself now, that no one talks about, particularly in photography, as to whether something is an accident or something is an intention.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting tension, I think.
It
there
is.
Have been things that I think I have, that surprised me. I look at the image. It was not an intention to have that there. But if you look at many, many, many things that you do, in this case, photographs I take, or you discover a kind of through line. And in that through line, it cannot simply be an accident. There has to be intention at some level.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. It's an unknown that opens, I think, the door to better work. And I'm going to say one last thing, because as you can tell, all my answers have multiple answers. And that is, well, I'm glad you think so. It leads to a worldview, which I think that art making can and does. It is, and I'm just going to expand on that a little. So much of the world, and I'll speak to a certain extent to the United States, but much broader, sees the world, and this is among very intelligent people, as a positive attitude or a negative attitude. That's too easy.
It is. Yeah, I agree.
It's too easy. And so what I try to get at is the complexity of things without complicating it in a way that makes it difficult, but in a way that says, as the photos are, that the world is multi-layered and it doesn't lend itself to simple certainties or simple images. Again, without making it complex in the wrong way, I think the work is quite open, but the multi-layeredness is the more, as I write about in the introduction to the book we're talking about, the sense that the image has something more.
Yeah. Yeah.
So all that goes to what you've asked me.
Yeah, I know. But your book is about time, spirit, and transformation. And we talked already about it, but it's something that really speaks to me. Looking at the photos and how would you define time? Is that relative to you, looking back?
Oh, I don't think we can define time, either personally or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm a great believer, for example, in the fact that there's no such thing as the present, because by the time the present, as we know it, reaches us even instantaneously, it's coming to us through light years.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it? You know, is it a present or is it something that is the past? Well, not exactly. We have these handles that make sense of the world, and they're good handles, useful ones, past, present, future, and we live by them. But in terms of defining it, I guess the word that comes to mind is fluid.
Yeah. And that is something that I can relate to. As an artist, as a musician, you can be in that state that time becomes fluid.
Well, certainly that state, which of course is that one that's
and also
more low, but I mean something else too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, because you also talked about walking and how walking made you aware and deeply aware of what you were seeing around you. And that, well, I can relate to that because I walk a lot because of that. Also because I did Julia Cameron's books, Walking in This World, etc. And it brings, well, me, it always gives idea. And then I am in a different time. So that's different than being in flow, but then I am in a different kind of time.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, I think in any given instant in a day, we are in different times.
Yeah.
There's the time of the moment when suddenly one can be ambushed by a memory.
Mm-hmm.
Not something you're trying to recall, but synapses deliver it, you know?
No.
Are they delivering the past? Well, sort of, kind of. Are they delivering an interpretation of the past?
Mm-hmm.
More like.
Mm-hmm.
Are they delivering it as it impinges on the present? Is it offering something for the future? I think I'm going to diverge a little bit here, and this will either be to the point or not, but there's another book of mine that is not photography. It's called memoir, although that is not a word I like very much. I always hear it as me, memoir, me, moi.
Yeah.
But it is a book about something in my family as it intersects with science, history, memory, ideas. And I will tell you very briefly what it is. I could talk about that at some length, but I won't, why it relates to time. It's about something that happened in my family that's rather unusual. My mother, a second-generation immigrant family, was one of six children. Five young girls, one young boy. The boy was soon manifestly schizophrenic and terribly dangerously ill. One of the sisters, 15 years later, she was always fragile, emotionally fragile. Some things happened that made her much more so, and she was in an intractable, terrible depression. So with 15 years between them, they were each given and agreed to by my family a lobotomy. So that's two lobotomies in my family, two out of six, a third of my mother's family, however you want to look at it. And the book takes off from the place where I, as an adult, go, oh, how could this have happened?
Yeah.
And yes, two. I won't go on with that, but how this relates is that at some point in the book, my Uncle Benny, many years lobotomized, writes me a note. It's actually a get-well note. I was sick. You can see from the writing, this is not a well person himself by a long shot. It's wobbly, whatever. And the last line is, I hope we will all be together at Diane's house. Well, looking back after all these years and rediscovering, I thought, how could Benny hope? Because damage to the frontal lobes, which is what happens, is damage to the human capacity to look to the future.
Yeah.
And theoretically, Benny could not hope. And in the book, and I always think in this sort of a book, the I is a character, so I always put quotes on it, but it is me at the same time. Mm-hmm. I try to find that out, and I speak with psychologists of memory and a number of other people as one part of the book to essentially answer the question, how could a man who should not be able to hope? How could a man who did not have a sense of the future have a sense of the future? Or so it seemed. And what he was talking about was that he hoped that as we had every year as a family, we would be together at a cousin's house for Thanksgiving. Yeah. And the psychologist I spoke with said, no, he could not hope. He did not have a sense of the future. They just had no answer.
Hmm.
My answer, and now we circle back to your question about what time means to me, and tell me what it means to you, is an idea that I developed that hope is the friend of the present, not of the future. Although, well, that's true. Black and white, but the friend of the present. And that when Benny wrote that, it was not from the way that we ordinarily think of the future, of how we think of ourselves as central, our little selves, central to something that's going to happen in the future.
Mm-hmm.
That because this had happened, this event in Benny's life, he was able to have a sense of a kind of group happening of which he was a part.
No.
And that sense of group, not himself as an actor, was something that he could hope and say as a friend of the present to me. And to take that long story and circle back to it, what I'm getting at is I do think that so many of our ideas are kind of too cut and dry.
Mm-hmm.
The only way we can, and too categorical.
Yep.
The only way we can think of a future is in the future. The only way we can think of the self is as an actor in some point in time. And I think actually to answer this philosophically, which is the question you asked, it is philosophical, is that I think that we need, I don't want to be prescriptive, but we need to have more elastic, complex, and fluid sense of time, our place and our role in it, not necessarily as central actors.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'll just stop there. It took a lot to get to that point, but you see what I'm getting at. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. And I agree, because the time we have created is a very industrial form of time. It's like walking around with a card and you have to clock in and clock out. And that doesn't work like that. And our memories do not work like, our brains do not work like that. And I think that is the importance of being an artist, because you can tap into that.
Exactly. There's another pernicious use of time in the pernicious use, not time itself, which I fall into, which is to say things like, and this is very common, I've got to do more. How much I have to do today? I'm overwhelmed by this. It's just a whole kind of squeezing of time into an obligation for oneself that if one does not fulfill, one is in effect bad. I mean, that's an exaggerated way, but not that exaggerated.
Yeah.
And I think,
but that is something that we were taught.
Mm-hmm.
That is what we were taught, but that's not the truth.
No. And other cultures certainly do not live by that. I don't mean to glorify, aggrandize other cultures versus the West. There's, obviously a lot of latitude in there. But surely we have learned, and it really is antithetical to the creative process, we have learned to parcel time into little units of things that we...
Yeah.
And if we don't do, we're bad.
We're bad.
I know.
Yeah. You didn't do what you were supposed to do. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. We talked a little bit already about the walking part. And you write that finding that without a destination, I was more receptive to what was around me. So if you look at where we are now in this world, do you think there is a lack of that?
You know, I really don't know, because in some of your questions, you also asked about young people, and I'm picking up and bringing that into this answer. You know, I really don't like to pontificate. You know, I don't really know what it is for young people. I'm 81. I'm not young. I don't know. And I would be the first to say it. I don't have kids. I mean, I keep my eyes open. I try to know who Billie Eilish is, for example, and like her music, but I don't know whether kids are being damaged by not looking sufficiently, whether cell phones are causing our sense of openness and vision to atrophy. Perhaps so. You know, funny that you talk about walking. I do love to walk, but I'm not at this point in life a serious walker. I'm going to use walking at the moment as a metaphor for suspension. The kind of walking that I'm talking about, for not having that goal that forces one to have, like horses have blinders, go toward that goal, and those blinders prevent. Yesterday, I was walking along a street here I like very, very much. I was on the way to my gym class, and a couple of things happened, and they were really just little tiny things, and they're somewhat romantic things, which tends to happen sometimes in certain parts, at least of Mexico, not everywhere. Or there was a guy, and he was on the sidewalk and not particularly well-dressed, but playing the violin beautifully. And then there was a woman coming toward me who said hello, and then I realized she was somebody from a store that I had been in before. And then I went and got a cup of coffee at a very unusual, really eccentric coffee house cum antique cafe with a little boy who only spoke Spanish, who kept handing me coasters for my coffee and saying pancake, pancake. So he was trying to relate that in English. And I could go on, but I won't. Yeah. It was the world coming in, and it wasn't that I had taken a very long walk. I live in a town that's, its nickname is the town of fallen women, and fallen men now too, because not an obvious sense of the joke, but it's full of cobblestones and places to stumble, which I've done in the past and which I try very hard not to do now. And I spend a certain amount of time looking down as opposed to around. I just don't, and I don't want to stride forward in total confidence as I perhaps had more or less when I was younger. Scratch the word total in confidence. But the larger metaphor is the openness. I even had a destination, but I was not preoccupied with other things. Delight was coming at me. I welcomed it, which doesn't mean that it always has to be delight. It can be many other things. Ugliness, despair, many things. But I'm using it as the metaphor for being open.
And I love that.
Wants to achieve, want not to achieve, bad word.
Achieve is again.
Want to foster courage to nurture those words.
Oh, I love that. It gives so much openness and time to breathe.
And I love that. To look. You know, I was a little girl. I was always going, look, 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 and I still do that. And the greatest gift that I was given in childhood from another person was an aunt. I think I must have been about 9 or 10. And she once said to me, when I walk down the street with you, I see things I would not see.
Mm-hmm.
And such a simple thing. And I do. My mother loved art. This particular aunt loved words. Neither of them were people of education. They would have liked to have been. Circumstances didn't allow that to happen. Mm-hmm. But they had tremendous sensitivity. And it was the first time I went without knowing it. And I remember it all these years. Ah, there has to be some way that I'm seeing that's different. That's maybe mine.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a gift.
It is a gift. It is a gift.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. I remember when I was painting something and someone looked with me when I was doing that and they said, I don't see that. So yeah, but I do. Look. And they said, yeah, you see more than I do. So yeah, but I have trained myself to see. And I think that everyone can do that. Because when you do that, you open up and you see more. You get a broader perception. And that is wonderful because you also see opportunities for yourself and you enjoy things more. And you can be grateful for things you see because of their simple beauty, things that you didn't see before. So like this afternoon, I did before we started, I had a walk and I tend to have no AirPods in, no phone, nothing with me. I just want to be alone with nature. And there's this little stream and I see the littlest bird ever. And he was bathing. So there was a little branch that made a pool for him so he wouldn't get in the stream. And he was going on. And I just stood there and I had like, this is so magnificent. You just have to stare at it and look at it, how this little bird, the smallest I ever saw, was just puddling around and bathing and enjoying himself. And then he was gone again. Those little things are so beautiful to see. I mean, you don't even have the time to take your phone or whatever to make a photo. Because then before you have focused or found it, because it's so small, it's gone.
Well, I love your sense of the micro, because again, we tend to see a kind of view of what's in front of us.
Yeah.
But you were looking into something very small. And that's one of the advantages of looking, that scale becomes open, open to you. There was something else I just wanted to say from what you said, the walking, the bird. There's such a lovely image that I think I just kind of stopped there. But give me one moment because you can edit this and it will come back. Yes, two things. When I started, I wanted to take a photograph. That was the, so to speak, moment when I was walking without a destination. I was here, but here was much less sophisticated than it is now. And the only camera that was available, because I didn't have one with me and planned this, was a throwaway, a disposable, a single use.
You're right, that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it allowed me to see things differently, which was a great surprise. People don't usually use it that way, but because it doesn't have a depth of field, everything appears on the same plane. If you say it's okay not to have automatic focus, then you get rid of the conventional way of, I like this, it's sharp. Don't like that as much, it's blurry. You can't do that. You can't make those choices. And if you work with reflection, as I did for quite a while, and you do not let, you don't Well, you like blur. You don't necessarily have to have the world super sharp.
No.
You get a vision of the world that became very important to me for quite a long time that destabilized. You didn't know when you looked at my photographs where I was, unlike a lot of wonderful photographers who work with reflection, Lee Friedlander, Eugene Ace. You don't know where I am. And everything interpenetrates because of this flattening of foreground and background.
Yeah.
And so you don't know what is solid. You don't know what is fluid. Things create a boundary, borderless world, which I like very much, although I don't always do it any longer. But some people found that troubling. And there was a very interesting moment. I once had a show in which an architect looked at these photos big and was quite troubled by them because he couldn't establish his habitual sense of space.
Yeah. But I can understand that.
Yes.
For an architect. Definitely.
And went, oh, I want to walk right into that.
Yeah.
And so they were very different ways of being in the world. And I can understand and to a certain large extent sympathize with both. But the larger point of what you were saying is getting away from the habitual expectation, which, again, is one of the things that closes us down.
Yeah.
And when I was working with the disposable that way, I got a big kick. I remember there were many occasions. The particular one I was just remembering was being at a B&B in Utah, in obviously in the United States. And there were some people I didn't know. And one was, I think, a 17-year-old kid, give or take. And there was beautiful light in the room. And I was telling him a little bit about what I do. And then I asked him to walk with me to one of those glass-fronted cabinets that also had a wooden surface that had a lot of light on it. And I know that what he was expecting to see, what was inside the glass-fronted cabinet. But I asked him to look and look again, not with anything fancy, not with some special lens, just his eyes. And suddenly he saw that the room behind him was in front of him, that the layers of light and angles were creating something, that everything was different when he stopped expecting. And it was such a joy for me. So I looked at him with this huge smile, like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And, you know, you say you aim for simplicity, but your photos are very complex. And it is suggestion versus depiction.
Thank you. That's a perfect word. And it speaks to something else because, of course, simplicity is something that is not simple to necessarily achieve.
Mm.
As a writer, I remember saying about a particular book, Phantom Limb is its name, that I wanted the writing in it to be like a transparent stream.
Yeah.
And that you could see the rocks under it, but you didn't have to stumble or stay there. It was just this transparent stream. And it took me 10 years to achieve not just the writing, but also the idea behind what the whole book was going for.
Yeah.
So simplicity is an artistic venture as much as it is something simple.
Yeah.
That's true.
Well, maybe it is simplicity on the other end of complexity.
It's stripping away what isn't essential.
Yeah.
It's discovering faults in oneself.
Yeah.
I used to be a much fancier writer when I was younger. I somehow thought, and I was good. And when I was writing poetry, I could get these wonderful textures and, kind of a thicker language, etc. That's not have to do with whether it's straight ahead or oblique, because poetry tends to be oblique. That's in its nature. But it was in the density of the language. And then I realized that I really didn't want to be doing that exactly. So then I studied for a while with a poet who was extremely simple in his language, simple to the point that it was like, like brushing one's teeth or something, you know, just trying to get to that other place that was not beautiful language for its own. Well, nothing is wrong with beautiful language for its own sake. I think what was wrong with mine is there was a little element maybe of a kind of showing off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can do this. A kind of, this is what I think poetry is. I'm not going to go on with that. I don't want to excoriate myself. But it is, and it's not simply about being democratic, although God knows the disposable, as someone wrote about my work, is as democratic a tool as one could wish for, because sort of anyone can work with it. It's not lenses out to here that, no. And even now, I'm very low tech. It's discovering who you are and how you want to say it.
Yeah.
And that sounds so simple, but really, as you know, isn't
at it isn't at all. No.
It's a matter of style, but it isn't only a matter of style. Style is a way of self-expression. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of work toward, in my case, the simplicity that was right for me, that sometimes was embodied in these complicated images,
yeah.
Complex images, but they weren't complex for their own sake. They weren't complex for saying, mm-hmm. Hey, me. They were complex for saying, this is a multi-layered, mysterious world, particularly yeah. The earlier ones.
Yeah.
So simplicity, I'm trying to, I think, as they say in academic circles, of which I am adjacent, but mm-hmm. not a part, unpack those, you know.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Let's go to your first collaboration with José Alberto Romero Romano. Do I pronounce that well?
Perfect. Yeah, you couldn't have done it better. We're going to call him Alberto.
Alberto.
Because I yeah. called him, although
okay.
José in certain areas is, most of his life is actually known as Joe. But mm-hmm. I sort of, José, Joe. But I just started calling him Alberto, and that is who he is in the book, and that is who he is in our friendship.
Yeah. Yeah. So he looks at photos differently than you do, which I like, because it's a completely different input. It also sometimes places me off. Like, oh, okay, this is really literally, but I see and feel something different in the photo. And I know some artists who don't like their work to be seen differently than what they meant it to be. How was that experience for you, also collaborating for the very first time with someone?
Yeah, well, certainly, years ago I worked in film, and that meant lots of collaboration, whatever. Although I have to say, as time went on, I really discovered, I just like to be alone, frankly. Mm-hmm. I really do. I am that classic version of an introvert, which is not somebody, I mean, I can be as social as anybody, not quite, but, mm-hmm. but I love the definition that says the introvert is somebody who is drained by too much exposure with other people. And yep. the extrovert is somebody who is sustained and finds it inspiring.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of a classic introvert that way. And so I really find my own company just fine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But first came this notion of, I have a book of photographs from this period of time, but I don't want them to be a book. They're not good enough as my view of Mexico, because I don't want my view of Mexico. So Alberto was recommended to my husband and me as a very skilled physical therapist, which he is. And I had made a small studio for myself where the most important thing, and I mentioned this in the coda of the book, was to have sheetrock on the wall. So, or whatever it's called, I don't know. And, it, you know, it's the material that allows you to take little pushpins